Welcome to the Songs of Note podcast, where we talk about the songs we love and the stories behind them. I'm your host, Ryan Gregg.
Hey, this is Ryan. Thank you so much for joining me for the Songs of Note podcast. Something I appreciate with you guys being willing to listen to these shows is, you know, I if you're listening, then I think you're indulging my search to hear a little bit more, to go in depth about something. And hopefully in some instances, you're even willing to go hear about a band or an artist or deep dive into stories that you may or may not know the artist, or you may or may not love the artist. So this is an episode that I just think it's a cool music connection that happened unexpectedly. So here's the story. You guys, if you listen to the show, you got to know that I love Elliott Smith. I think I'm going to say it. Then I said it in the interview. I said, I think he's the best singer-songwriter of all time. You can yell at me. You can yell in your car, but I can't hear you. If you're working out and you're going, wrong, it's Bob Dylan, I can't hear you. But that's just my opinion, because I've argued about it on I've given my point on other episodes. There's an interview with his biographer, Elliott Smith's biographer, William Todd Schultz, where we talk about it. But I think he is the best, and we talk about it a little bit in this interview. But today's episode is going to be revolving around Elliott. But the way that we got to Elliott is kind of cool. So I had been researching. I was looking for Elliott Smith print photos to purchase, because, you know, we've talked about that on some recent episodes. And I had come across a photographer named Dominic Desaia. I hope I'm saying that right. And he's a really great photographer who does professional photos, and a ton of them were like from of athletes and different type stuff. I found him and got in contact with him, that he had some cool pictures from a show he had been to with Elliott. So I ended up purchasing one, and it's just this beautiful photo that he signed of a show that he saw towards the end of Elliott's life. And it was just a great photo. And I said, hey, you know, I like talking to photographers about shows and about artists, and would you want to come on? He's like, no, you know, he's like, I'm not the music guy. My buddy Joel Graves is the music guy. And I said, well, you know, can you tell me a little bit about him? He's like, oh, well, he purchased New Monkey Studio. So if you're listening to this and you're like, what is that? Who is that? Well, New Monkey Studio was a studio that Elliott Smith built and owned before his death. And Elliott's music is full of Beatles influences. And if you know anything about the Beatles recording history, they were on the cutting edge of not only quality and creativity, but also just killer gear that gearheads just will die over. I mean, just the coolest stuff. So even if you don't know all the gear stuff, that's okay. You don't need to know that for this interview. What you do need to know, and what I think is cool to know, is there's a couple things we talk about. We talk about what owning the studio that used to be owned by Elliott Smith has meant to Joel, how he actually had Jeff Emerick, who was an engineer for the Beatles, come into the studio, and he got to play Elliott's music for him. And Jeff even recognized the Abbey Road piano as soon as he's playing the track, which is pretty incredible. He talks about how he is friends with Neil Young. He's been friends with Neil Young like more than half his life. He worked for him. He toured with Father John Misty. I mean, there's just tons of like cool stories here that Joel is just overflowing with. And he's just a really cool guy to get to chat with and connect with. So as you're listening to this interview, if you don't know anything about recording, that's fine. If you don't know anything about recording gear, that's fine. The things that I think are interesting are that there's an artist that I find in the highest regard, and that Joel did in the same way. And he was willing to go in and purchase a studio that this artist owned, and has spent the last, what I think he said, 16 years owning it and building into it and creating an environment that's great for musicians to come and make albums and make music and continue the legacy that Elliott Smith had started. And so, this is the interview with Joel Graves. I'm going to put a link to New Monkey Studio so you can check it out online if you want in the show notes. And let's head on over to the interview. This is Joel Graves. Hey, this is Ryan. I am so glad to be talking with Joel Graves today. Joel, it is really a pleasure to get to chat with you, and thanks for coming on the show.
Hey, Ryan. Thanks for having me.
Well, so it's really interesting the way that you and I have connected, and I kind of set up how we got connected in the intro to the episode. But I'd love for people to get to know a little bit more about you, because I think you have a really interesting story, and you were involved with people that I find are interesting as well. So I'd love to know a little bit about you. Where did you grow up, and how'd you get into music in the first place?
Yeah. Well, I grew up mainly in Orange County, California, in a town called Fountain Valley, which is kind of right next to Huntington Beach. And as soon as I could move out of that area and just start learning and expanding a bit, I moved to Los Angeles first to attend college, which is actually where I met Dominic. I was already a huge fan of music. My parents are both music fans, and I grew up around a lot of oldies and 60s music, you know, like a lot of American kids did.
The good stuff.
Yeah. So, I mean, my brother and I used to, I think we pretty much wore through my parents' copy of Sgt. Pepper's and like their Creedence records and stuff like that. As like little kids, I got way into it, which kind of just stuck throughout my life. And once I was in college, I was playing a little bit, but I started playing more seriously and started playing in bands and stuff. And I was at a party one night. And being a wallflower, because I'm not that good at being social sometimes, especially in settings where I don't know a lot of people.
Sure.
I started talking to this guy, a fellow freshman named Dominic Desaia, who let me know that he was about to head up to the Bridge School benefit concerts that Neil Young was putting on
in
the Bay Area the following weekend.
Nice.
And I was planning to go as well. So this was 94. It was a really good year, probably.
Pearl Jam there?
Pearl Jam year.
I'm jealous.
I think it was maybe their first couple shows with Jack Irons.
Nice.
It was just a really great show. I mean, I remember, there was a bunch of just really interesting things going on. I think Petty was that year too.
Oh gosh, really?
There was obviously those shows were always stacked, but so we ended up hooking up there and hanging out over the weekend. I think maybe we drove up. I can't remember if we drove up to the show together or not, but so that was kind of the start of me kind of like exploring more stuff, going to concerts and stuff, and I became friends with Dominic. We started playing music together. I ended up sticking with music. I got a mass communications degree at UCLA and began interning at a major record label when I was still in college. So I started learning the business side of things and how that all worked and what the deal was, at least in that world. I could kind of see what was going on. And when that time ended for me to, kind of get out of school, I started looking for a job, and I found an internship at Vapor Records, it took a little bit of like elbow grease to get the job, I guess you could say.
So is this Neil Young's label?
Yes. So Vapor, at this time I was getting out of school. It's like, this is like 97 or something like that.
Nice.
And, took this internship, and I also took an internship at Sound City Studios.
What?
In Van Nuys. So
are you serious?
I was working for,
Neil
Young, and I'm like 20, 21, so I was just like taking everything in. And so, and I was working a lot of like crazy 18 hour days and stuff like that, working all night at the studio, getting up and interning at Vapor, and just, just madness. At the same time, I was playing and stuff too. So I was kind of like moving myself along the process.
We're all in it.
And I kind of started working those jobs and just trying to learn more about music. And, Robert Capodona was the person who picked up the phone when I called Vapor and gave me the the internship initially. We became good friends and later on ended up buying the studio together. New Monkey Studio, which is part of why.
That's cool.
Part of why I think we're talking today.
Yeah. I didn't know that was the connection. Okay.
So it's all very interconnected in this wild web that, you know, just kind of happened naturally. I just followed the doors that opened and, you know, this life that I've been living is just kind of unfolded this way. Man. So at the same time, while I was doing those internships and which turned into jobs where I was getting paid and stuff like that. One of the bands that I was working with at Sound City asked me if I would go out and play guitar with them on tour. And I had played guitar on one track on the record. Actually my first time, like doing like a real major label professional recording was at The Village, in West LA, which is a legendary place, which I was just a kid like trembling. But so I ended up going on tour with them and getting to play CBGB's my first time in New York. And,
nice.
Just having, you know, just as a kid, like really getting finally getting to get out and get a touring experience. And I learned a lot with that band and just quickly got into like trying to form bands and get my own thing going. So I also kind of in the early 2000s kind of started playing with some friends. I was managing and playing with this band called Early Mart here.
Nice.
Early Mart was a really active band that was touring a bunch and making records. Aaron Espinoza, the main singer and songwriter in the band and kind of force behind the band, has his own studio that there's a big scene that kind of revolves around and stuff there in LA called The Ship. I started playing in that band and two of the members of the band, Ariana Murray and Scott McPherson, had just started playing in Elliot's band at the end, very end of his life.
Oh, interesting. So like 2002, 2003 tight, like time period, you think?
Yeah. In Early Mart at the time of Elliot's death.
Okay.
Just to give you a little bit of immediate, like what happened immediately, what was going on before we bought the studio.
Man.
So, okay. Elliot passed, which was, incredibly like shocking, disappointing, confusing thing for all of us and our group of friends because, he was our favorite. He was our guy. I think everybody respected him on every level. And he was just such a talented lyricist and pianist, guitar player, singer. I mean, just you name it.
Everything.
He was just so incredibly talented. And months passed, and I don't think I was even really fully aware of that he owned a studio in Van Nuys, which is just over the hill from Westwood and stuff. It's kind of near where the 405 and 101 freeways meet in Los Angeles. If anybody listening wants a kind of a location reference.
Nice.
And so we kind of, yeah, I guess he had bought the studio. And I'm assuming with funds from some of his publishing deals and his record deal with DreamWorks and so forth, and had been buying a bunch of gear and him recording his friends' bands there. He'd been recording the Blues Explosion there, and some of the Flaming Lips dudes had been coming around, and it sounded like there was a lot of cool shit going on with Elliot's friends and stuff like that. So when he passed, the family had to make a decision what to do with the space. And I think ultimately, I don't know if it was a financial decision or what, but they decided the best thing to do was to sell the studio.
Mm-hmm.
And I found out about it. I got I can't remember if it was an email or a call from my good friend, a music writer named Karen Rose. And she said, yo, check this out. Elliot's studio is for sale, and I think this may be interesting to you.
Huh.
And of course I was like, F yeah, it is. I'm down. I would like to know what's going on with this.
Yeah.
And, I told Robert about it, who we had been working at Vapor at that point for several years together. And Vapor is also Lookout Management. So that's also was Elliot Roberts and Frank Gironda and Bonnie Levitin's office, their company, where a lot of artists ranging from like Billy Corgan to Mazzy Star, Spiritualized, the Beta Band. All of this stuff is all like, I guess it's all a factor. It's all an influence. It all kind of created how it got to where it got. But Robert and I felt like this would be a cool thing to get into. And so we went and looked at the studio and met with Ashley Welsh, who was Elliot's sister. Who was a good friend and somebody that I respected a lot and just thought was really cool. And she showed us around the place and we were pretty blown away. It was, it seemed doable. It was the size and the amount of gear and all that stuff. It seemed like, well, I think we can do this. I think we can handle this. And we sat down and tried to figure out the financials and it didn't make sense. We were like, there's no way we can afford to do this. We ended up kind of balking and backing away from making an offer or anything like that formally. Several months later, Ashley called me and was like, hey, the family is thinking about selling Elliot's place to a studio broker because they haven't found the right buyer yet. And what that means basically is that a studio broker would take it and sell off all the pieces of gear individually to try to make as much money as possible from it, irregardless of any sentimental value or historical value the stuff may have to Elliot.
So like for people listening, he could have had like, I'm sure he did have incredible gear and does, or, you know, the gear is great. And then you're saying somebody would come in and be like, we're just going to go put this stuff on eBay or wherever, and we're going to get the highest amount, and leaving out the fact that it was owned and used by Elliot Smith as a factor. Is that right?
Well, I'm sure they would have used his name to some degree to try to get money out of it, because at that point it would have been out of the family's hands, where the family, of course, I think, you know, obviously have tried to handle things with great diligence and respect for his legacy. But they were at a point where, you know, it's like, okay, we're going to hand this plate off to somebody else and eventually they're going to do what they want to do with it. So Ashley kind of said, you know, I think that if you guys made an offer that was acceptable to them, that they would be pretty happy to know that it was being kept within the music community. And his sort of circle of friends of people who are working and doing stuff. It was kind of just like, if I don't want to say it fell into our laps, but it kind of did. And this just maybe 3 months later, the price had gone down almost in half of what they were asking.
So, it made it
suddenly we were like, okay, now it is possible. So we ended up going for it, and I think we're coming up on year 17 in August.
Well, that's awesome. Thanks for telling that story. I mean, that that's really what I was curious about, is how did that start, and how'd you get introduced to the family, and how did you purchase it? So that is totally cool. I want to go back on a couple things that you had said, if I could. So for your past experience, looking back to when you worked at Vapor, did you hang out with Neil Young? Did you interact with him much, or was he kind of just off on his ranch, or what was that like?
I mean, it's hard for me to even scratch the surface of what my relationship with Neil has been like over the years, because I was a 17-year-old kid with my two, three buddies in a living room during high school playing Rockin' in the Free World for 2 hours, nonstop. So to eventually, start working for Neil, it was a cool thing for me, because, and I went for Neil. I looked up Neil's company because when I heard that he owned an independent record label and it was in the town that I lived in. I was like, okay, this is something that appeals to me. And I mean, of course I respect Neil, penultimately, like a lot of people do, as a consummate artist. And, I had so much respect for the way that he ran his career, and I was a fan of his music and his heart and his passion and his truth. And so I just, you know, I was so into that. And I, next thing I know, I'm meeting him. And over the years, it's developed beyond, you know, I mean, I've known Neil, I'm 46 now, and I've known Neil since I was probably around, yeah, I guess 20, 21.
That's wild. That's crazy.
So it's, I was super intimidated by him when I met him. He's a pretty, I don't know what the right word is. He's, you know, he's, I hear people compare him to like kind of a grizzly bear at times. And
yeah,
he does have this, this heaviness of presence that is pretty intimidating, especially for a kid meeting him, you know.
Yeah, man.
And that took me a long time to kind of get over that. And then over the years, I mean, it changed to where, you know, I've been up to their place a bunch, and I've spent time with all of their families for such a long period of time that it's pretty surprising. And it also feels sort of natural. Like I've always felt comfortable within their world because it's in line with what I like and what I believe in.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was just kind of a natural fit for me. And eventually when I was in Early Mart, I went to Elliot and was like, hey, I'm in this band that's doing pretty well. Like, do you guys have any interest in? And he was like, yeah, let me listen to it. And he was like, let me check it out. And nothing ever really happened. And several years later, I had started my own band with Russ Pollard, who had been playing with Elliot and had his own band, Alaska, which I really liked.
Oh, yeah, I like that band.
And wow. And he had played with Sebado and the Folk Implosion. And
nice.
I met Russ actually through a toolbox that he left at the studio that said Russ Pollard and Friends. So when we bought the studio, I was like, this is obviously Russell's, so I'm going to find him. We had mutual friends, so I found him. He came over to the studio to come see the studio again because he hadn't been in a while, and I gave him his toolbox back. And so eventually Everest was the band that we started together. And we decided to make a record. We had, Russ had been writing these really great acoustic songs that he started sharing with us, and we loved them and we wanted to record them and put them out in the world. And him and Jason Soda and I started collaborating on stuff in the living room, and we became a band. And we decided to make a record at New Monkey, which is always a thrill for me. I still, every time I get to go in there, I feel lucky to have time to be there and relax and record in that environment. And we went and made an album in a week and mixed it in a week, and we were done. And I called up Elliot and was like, I don't think I called him. I think I told him face to face. I was like, hey, I'd like to play you this. Mm. And he was like, of course. And so he came down to the studio and met us at New Monkey and listened to the entire finished record with us. And he didn't exactly offer us a deal on the spot, but he pretty much said, I love this. I want to put this out.
Wow.
So we were like, okay, this is great. And within a matter of, I feel like it felt like weeks, maybe it was months, but they had us, they asked us if we wanted to do some, they wanted to set up some shows for us during the Sundance Film Fest, mainly because Neil was going to be there.
Okay.
And I think in hindsight, and they wanted to give us some, you know, start giving us some exposure. But we played a little tiny club in Utah, and lo and behold, you know, Neil's standing 15 feet in front of us in this tiny club in the crowd watching us play. It was pretty inspiring. It was definitely, you know, we felt like, okay, we're starting to get somewhere. And they offered us a tour with Neil like really quickly right after that. I think he just needed to see that we were real live.
Okay.
And we were all pretty, you know, seasoned live touring musicians at that point, so we were like, bring it on, we're ready.
Yeah.
So and then we ended up getting I think 5 different tours opening for Neil.
That's awesome.
So including in Europe. And so it turned into this whole beautiful thing where all of our records, we put out 3 full length records that were all associated with Vapor. They've been a huge part of our career. And I mean, literally I think we did about 50 arena shows opening for Neil.
Wow.
Including like three at Madison Square Garden and places like that. It was like totally mind blowing.
So cool. Because
these were the things that, you know, when I was 16, 17, playing my
right
and, you know, playing with Eric and Sam and in the living room, you know, I had no idea that what it was going to become. And I mean, I kind of knew because I was really into it. I would learn songs by ear and I was just like,
yeah.
So eventually, yeah, kind of we got to this point where Everest got onto Letterman and
nice.
Yeah, we did all the late night talk shows and had a really fun run and then kind of took hiatus for, yeah, it's been almost 8 or 9 years. We've kind of been on a pause and have actually been recording again last year.
Nice.
So there's a new record in the works and which we're all really excited to share with everybody. It's been a wild journey for me.
No kidding. Well, thanks.
Run the gamut.
Thanks for sharing that. Okay. So that brings up a couple more questions. So for me, like Neil Young is somebody who I just love forever. And as a songwriter, somebody I think incredibly highly of. And then Elliot Smith to me combined a couple different things. He not only brought the songwriting craft, and he brought a wide expanse of like chord and melodic sophistication to his writing that a lot of people don't have. And for me, he's my favorite songwriter. I think he's some people are going to disagree, but I think he's the best songwriter of all time, if I had to say it. So that's how hardcore I'm in on Elliot Smith. I just love him so much. So here's my question is,
I would put him right there.
Oh man, I love it. I love that. Especially for you having such close interaction with him. That's cool.
I only met Elliot in passing, and I met him at, you know, like shook his hand a couple times, unfortunately.
Okay.
Like in a bar, like met him and said hello, and my friends were friends with him.
Okay.
I was pretty intimidated by him too, because he was quiet and he was somebody else I loved and respected. So.
Well,
sorry, you were saying.
No, that's interesting. That's very interesting. My question was, did Neil Young know about Elliot Smith? Did Neil Young ever listen to Elliot Smith's music, or was he aware of him because of you, or did you ever talk about him?
You know, I'm not really sure. There's a story actually about his manager, Elliot, though, Elliot Roberts. I've had two kind of important Elliots in my life. His manager, Elliot Roberts, was somebody whose roof I worked under for almost 15 years. Mm. So I got really close with him and his whole organization. And Elliot, on the day that Elliot Smith died, I had actually been driving. Elliot had gotten to, I think, a car accident or something like that. And Elliot Roberts, sorry, I should keep clarifying this so it doesn't get too confusing. So I'm going to work. Elliot Roberts, my boss, his car was in the shop and needed a ride to go get his car. So I gave him a ride over there. He's in my car with me. And I played him a bunch of Elliot Smith just the whole time. And he ends up wanting to run some errands. And we end up like going and doing a bunch of stuff together before going to get his car. So the whole morning we ended up listening to Elliot the morning that he died.
Oh, weird.
And we got back to the office that afternoon and got word. And he had asked me while I was playing for him, who is this? What's the story? Do you think he'd be into playing? And I told him he's on DreamWorks. He's been really successful. Like, you guys should know about him. He's a legit, you know, artist. And he was into it. And he was like, oh, I need to call Marcia and you know, maybe he might be a good one for Bridge because he heard that it was a bunch of acoustic stuff.
Oh man, how crazy.
He was into the idea of having Elliot like play Bridge. And,
wow.
And we literally got back to the office that afternoon and found out that he was dead.
Oh man.
And I haven't really told that story to anyone, maybe a couple of my close friends, because it haunts me. It's almost, I don't know if that's the universe talking or what. I listen to Elliot a lot, but that morning in particular, to listen to him back to back to back, I mean, just kept his record spinning as we were driving around.
Yeah.
On my iPod at the time.
Yeah.
I think it was off iPod. Yeah, pretty sure. So, yeah, it's kind of an eerie thing. So even there, there was a small connection of like, I got to tell Elliot Roberts about Elliot. And I had another fun experience with playing Elliot for someone a couple years ago, too. In that I was coming back from Europe. So also as a career path, I've gone on in the last several years to be doing road work as a guitar tech and a stage manager. I've been a tour manager, a bunch of different things for touring bands. Uh-huh. So I've been doing that as well over the years. And basically, I was over in Europe with Father John Misty.
I love him. I love him.
And I've been working with Father John Misty since 2016 or 17.
Man.
Almost exclusively. And we were in Europe, and Greg, who is our my partner in New Monkey now and our chief head engineer who kind of looks after things, calls me up and he's like, hey, Jeff Emmerich, hit us up out of the blue.
Beatles Jeff Emmerich?
Yes.
Oh my
about
gosh.
Coming to have a look at the studio because they heard that we have a Trident A range and he was interested in checking it out. Amongst other things, but that was kind of the gist of what I had heard. Well, this meeting was scheduled for maybe an hour after I landed back in LA from Europe. And I ended up getting in a car, going straight to New Monkey after landing from, you know, being in Europe for a month or something on tour, doing festivals with Father John Misty.
Wow.
Totally exhausted. I got to come home and go to meet Jeff Emmerich at the studio.
And
for anyone listening who's not familiar with Jeff Emmerich, he was one of the major recording engineers for the Beatles, who innovated so many recording techniques and used so much of the gear that Elliot bought and was inspired to buy because of what Jeff Emmerich had done recording the Beatles.
Wow.
I don't think there's any refuting that Elliot was a Beatles aficionado.
Yeah.
So I got to come back and we see Jeff Emmerich sitting in our control room.
Man.
And we ended up having about a 2-hour meeting with him, and he told us all kinds of stories about how he liked to record bass and how he mic'd Ringo's kit. And
it's
just unbelievable.
That's crazy.
There was no question off limits, and I had plenty of them.
Yeah.
And everyone did.
I bet.
It was a great meeting, and we wanted to play him some stuff so he could hear what the room sounded like, what the control room felt like, and all that. And I chose Figure Eight to play him.
Nice.
Because I figured he would appreciate the stuff. And, I mean, talk about golden ears. He picked out the one of the Abbey Road pianos.
Is that right?
I think he had a nickname for it.
Ugh.
And he was right.
That's crazy.
Right. And he sat and listened intently.
Hmm.
And that felt really good.
Yeah.
To know that Jeff Emmerich was sitting in Elliot's studio in front of Elliot's console and Elliot's speakers listening to Elliot, even though Elliot wasn't there. The echo made it through, and it made it to, you know, this legend's ears. And he really, really seemed to enjoy it. And he listened intently, like somebody of his stature you would expect. He was incredible. And he ended up passing, a year or two after that meeting, I guess, fairly recently. So that was an intense meeting, but a cool time where I got to share music with someone else who I think was, you know, I think Elliot probably would have been like.
So stoked. you'd have to think. No kidding. Oh, well, thanks for sharing that. That is totally cool. Yeah. Well, so was it question on something you mentioned. I think you mentioned the Trident board. Is this the board that I read about that Ellie was trying to fix and repair during the last year or two of his life, and it was just driving him crazy because he couldn't get it fixed? Is that this one, or is that a different one?
Well, the console has always been a bit of an enigma. So I'm sure that it was a difficulty for him. There's evidence that he was resoldering the patch bay himself.
Man, that's what I'm thinking of.
Doing a bunch of hardcore work on it himself. But he was also buying a ton of gear, and everything was kind of in a question mark status of like, is it working? Is it not?
Mm.
And I think that he may have been in a situation where he had a lot of gear that was kind of, I mean, the console, it's, you know, built in the early 70s, sometime between 71 and 73, we think. We think it's number 3 of only 13 of these Trident A-range consoles that were made. And it basically, you know, was such a rare thing that not a lot of people can work on it. It is tricky. And also it's old. So all the capacitors are drying out and things, you know, the parts do have half-lives and start going out and failing. So I think that there's a possibility he was even trying to test gear on things that could have been broken. And it just sounds like he was in a difficult maze of trying to figure out what was going on and what was working.
Gotcha.
And it seemed like he had a lot of techs coming in and out, and we had heard that he felt like some of them had ripped him off. And it's tough to, you know, sometimes somebody thinks they fixed something and they didn't. And, you know, you don't always know for sure if something's intermittent, it may work one day and not the next. And it's just, there's so many intricacies to this, and he was in for it. He was studying engineering books, tons of electrical engineering books, as well as audio engineering books at the studio.
Wow.
Things of that nature. And he wasn't afraid to pull out the soldering iron and work on some stuff himself. So he was a, you know, incredibly intelligent cat. So he was capable of doing any of that stuff. I mean, we've heard stories of him staying in the studio for 3 weeks on end.
Huh.
You know,
that's interesting.
And, you know, some of it wasn't all positive. I think that he was also, you know, going down some addiction rabbit holes and stuff like that too, that we found some evidence of through the years, and some things stashed away and nobody thought anybody would ever found, but some things like that exist. And you know, it's sounds like he was at the other end of that by the end of his life. It's
right.
Like he had kind of
come out,
started to correct things and was starting to get a handle on some of his self-medication, I suppose.
Well, for people who are I guess the question is, you know, what was it about New Monkey that made you really want to get involved? Was it specifically Elliot, or was it also known he had all this cool Beatles gear? Was it the combo? Like, for people who are interested in, like, gosh, what if I wanted to come and record at New Monkey? What were the things that stuck out to you and that stick out to you now? Is what make y'all unique?
I think the things that stuck out to me, I think it was equal. Elliot's presence is big to me. I care about that. Some people don't. To me, I want to be a custodian of his place and keep it, you know, a place that is a warm vibe for people to come and feel free to do what they need to do. So that's one aspect of it. And I've tried to bring my own piece of this, of my own spirit into the studio by, like, just warming it up and, like, lighting it vibey and cleaning it up and organizing it and just trying to make it a good workplace that people can come in and work. The other thing is the huge factor is the gear is, like, it's some one-of-a-kind stuff. Or not one-of-a-kind, but it's, you know, it's stuff that's becoming unobtainium quickly. There's a Fairchild 670 limiter, tube limiter compressor there that's, you know, it's one of the most legendary pieces of gear in recording history.
Huh.
And Elliot knew this, and he knew that the Beatles liked to run all types of things through it, bass, drums, vocals.
That's cool.
And so Elliot was like, you know, I'm going to get one of those. When he came into money, he invested in this gear. Huh. He bought a vintage U48 tube microphone. They're expensive now. Those are the mics that the Beatles sang into at Abbey Road. And I'm not saying this was an Abbey Road mic, but he understood that, you know, the signal path was really pure for a lot of his favorite recordings. And he went for that. So he bought all this incredible recording gear, the outboard gear. I mean, I go look at the list on our website. It's, if you're into that sort of thing, it's fun to geek out on. There's just a ton of fun stuff. I think there's something like 26 channels of just, like, limiting and compression in the rack.
Wow.
And, like, a good amount of them are, like, vintage tube units and stuff. It's like really fun stuff to mess around with.
That's
and,
totally, you know,
so
cool.
He was buying, like, gate stay levels, and there's a UA 175. There's just, like, some really odd, cool gear that he bought. And like, we got an opportunity basically we took out a loan to buy the studio, and by doing so, which we now own the stuff. Yeah. We have some priceless pieces of gear. The console also, I mean, obviously is kind of the centerpiece.
Sure.
It was used on records that we know of by Rush and, Cat Stevens, obviously Elliot. And in our time, it's been used by a bunch of brilliant folks that we're really proud to have used it, like Beck and Kim Deal and Father John Misty. And
totally cool.
So, you know, it's a special place to us, and it has great gear, but it's a very humble vibe. We came up as a studio at a time when most studios were closing.
Mm.
So we kind of jumped right in, like, hey, let's do this, just as we watched all the big ships sink.
Gotcha.
And we were like, okay, we got to start bailing water now.
Yeah, yeah.
And fortunately, our boat is small enough that we may be able to survive.
Gotcha.
And
gotcha.
That's kind of what's happened. Pandemic, you know, we had to respect all health protocols because it's not a small space, but the rooms are relatively enclosed. There's no windows. It's just like, you know, it's a pretty enclosed building. Once you go in there, you're inside the cocoon.
Yeah.
And, it hasn't been possible for us to really run during the pandemic.
Gotcha.
So we're in a position now where, we're revving back up and getting back to work. And, all of our key staff people are fully vaccinated and all that at this point, because we want to keep both ourselves and our staff and our clients healthy. So, we're kind of just getting back into things now, but we've expanded into the digital realm, past where Elliot had started, which he was already starting to record onto computers, using Mark of the Unicorn, gear. That was one of the things we chose to part with, actually, when we took over the studio, because we didn't want to base our system around that. It was kind of just a different digital audio recording system that wasn't super popular, and we feared that it would be difficult to integrate.
Okay.
So eventually we expanded into getting a Mac tower and Pro Tools 11 HD and beyond. Yeah. And, you know, we kind of caught ourselves up to being able to record, and so much interesting history.
Man, that's awesome. I love it. I mean, especially for people who are listening or into gear, I mean, I think they're going to be geeking out over it.
I'm a guitar player, so there's a ton of guitars and pedals and all that, amps and all that stuff. So we've just added piles and piles of gear over the years.
That's so fun, man. I would love to visit.
Anytime.
Yeah, thank you. All right. Well, so for people listening, you can check out the New Monkey Studio. I'm going to put the links in the show notes, and also go follow. It's at New Monkey Studio on all the social media platforms. But Joel, just greatly appreciate you getting to chat with you. Here's some stories about your time recording and your time at New Monkey, and your interaction with the things of Elliot, basically through New Monkey and your Neil Young stories as well. Greatly appreciate your time.
Thanks, Ryan. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Songs of Note podcast. Be sure and subscribe so you don't miss an episode. See you next time.